Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my great pleasure today to welcome Harvey Schwartz, the author of Building the Golden Gate Bridge, an oral history, dug into the history of who worked on the bridge, how they did it, what they accomplished, what trials they faced, and also the people who maintained this bridge for us. It's obviously an iconic bridge here in the San Francisco area, and this is the first thing that's shown on movies. If they want to say that there are people are in San Francisco, the first thing they show is the bridge. So a great history, gotten a lot of really good attention. Thank you very much for coming, Harvey.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming. I'd like to thank George for chairing the program and thank the Commonwealth Club for having me. Well, this evening I plan to tell you several things about the bridge. First of all, why I wrote this particular book, Building the Golden Gate Bridge, then to give you some historical background about the bridge, and finally to read some selected passages from the book. Well, I'm a labor historian who ventured into oral history in the 1980s when I was working on a project for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the West Coast Union that's associated with Harry Bridges, very famous union with sterling background and sterling history itself. I interviewed some veterans for the labor archives at San Francisco State University for the director there, Lynn Bonfield. These were veterans who had helped build the Golden Gate Bridge in the 1930s, between 1933 and 1937 when the bridge was built. They were interviewed for the 50th anniversary of the building of the bridge. So it was 1987 when most of the people in this book were interviewed. A few of the people in the book were interviewed at slightly different times. Well, I immediately thought that these were special interviews, that this was a special group of folks who had built an American icon. I thought there would be some interest in it. There was good literature on it at the time, already in the 1980s. Most of that literature dealt with the politics of the coming of the bridge or with the great engineers who helped build the bridge, particularly Joseph Strauss, who was the chief engineer on the project. Some of the literature also had good profiles of some of the workers and quoted some workers, all to the good. But I thought the workers deserved a book of their own, that their words should be presented to the public. So I thought maybe to give you an idea of my thinking and why I thought this was the case, I'm going to read you a quote here from a fellow named Al Zampa, who is an iron worker, high steel man, and he was interviewed in the 1980s. Here's the quote. "I never met Joseph Strauss, the chief engineer, but I saw him around a lot. I never shook hands with him or nothing. I was out there working. We were busy. We couldn't leave and go shake hands with him. That was for the upper man. See, all the big shots were the ones that were doing all the handshaking. In fact, they should have come out and handshaked us. We were the ones doing the work." Zampa's statement in many ways reflects this book, or what's in this book, it seems to me. What was required of me at this point, I guess, was to make a manuscript out of these interviews. Wasn't able to do it at the time. It came later in my life. But all along, I thought readers might be interested in the experience of the people who survived cold, dangerous conditions, the tragedy of seeing some of their co-workers killed, bad accidents happen. And these folks survived the Great Depression as well, along the way. So what better way, I thought, can you make, well, I don't know if that's quite the word, can you oblige or invite general readers to take a look at the experience of American workers in the 20th century, or at least to take a fresh look? I thought the bridge was the way to do it. It took me, as I say, a long time to complete the project, but be that as it may, before we get to some readings of the book itself, I want to give you some background on the bridge. Well, the idea to span the Golden Gate, the aptly named Golden Gate, was first poised by a fellow named Joshua Norton. And he posed his idea in 1869. Nobody took him seriously. He was actually the self-styled Emperor Norton, the Emperor of California, I believe, and Mexico, but he was self-styled, and he wore a military uniform of his own making, and there's the Emperor Norton. Well, nobody took him seriously at the time, but 50 years later, the San Francisco city engineer, Michael O'Shaughnessy, began to discuss the idea around 1916, this is, with an experienced bridge builder named Joseph Strauss. Well, Joseph Strauss thought this was a terrific idea, and throughout the 1920s, he propagandized the idea or spread the idea throughout Northern California. What's interesting to me is that in some ways, this beautiful bridge that we know so well didn't come to pass easily. First of all, it was clear in the 1920s there was a need for something like this because there was so much traffic, and the ferry boats were backed up as they tried to take people across the water. However, the ferry boat interests opposed the coming of the bridge because they wanted to continue to make profits by ferrying people across from Marin County to San Francisco and so forth. So, you know, they put up a big fight, lobbyists in the state legislature and so forth. There were even some suits. There were objections from the Army and also from the Navy. This at that time was the Army Air Corps, and they said, you know, if the bridge is bombed or whatever by an enemy, then they'll block the way to the bay, and that's going to be terrible for us. Environmentalists also opposed the idea in many cases. They felt, well, the opening to the bay is awfully beautiful the way it is. It's very natural, and it should stay that way. So there were objections to be overcome. But I think in many ways the biggest obstacle to us getting the beautiful bridge we got came from Joseph Strauss himself. He made a design in 1921 for the bridge, which was a combination hybrid cantilever bridge and suspension bridge. A cantilever bridge depends on strength and power, and it reaches out like that, and it is supported by a series of pieces of metal spans and things that look like a tinker toy. And so think about the old Oakland Bay Bridge when you think about a cantilever bridge. You know, with it stretched out like that and depended on power. That is the road, but it would stretch out like that. The suspension bridge is suspended from suspender cables, which are held up by very large and strong main cables that go over, that are horizontal, that go over saddles. They're called at the top of the towers and go like that. So they go up like that and they go down like that. Well, what happened was that people thought this was not a very prepossessing design, although it was a lead design for some time. But there was an employee named Charles Ellis of Strauss, who was a math expert, who was a professor, and he said that he could come up with the design that would allow a suspension bridge to be built, which is what we got in the long run. That it would be 1.7 miles. It would be the longest suspension bridge of its type in the world, and it was for several years until the 1960s. Well, for his trouble, and Strauss's design is really what you're looking at, Strauss was fired in December 1931 by Strauss. And Ellis never got the credit that he really deserved for the design of the bridge that we've come to know. There was another obstacle, if you want to call it that way, to the bridge coming out as well as it did, and that was the color. It was suggested that international orange would be the best color. This was suggested by Irving Morrow, who is a designer on the project, and he said, if you look at the color of the Marin County headlands, this is going to be the right color. He picked that because the primer originally was pretty close to that. Well, he also designed the overhead arch at Fort Point, which saved Fort Point. It's down the San Francisco side of the bridge. He also designed the 746-foot tower Art Deco lines, too. So Morrow was an important figure. It was finally decided that that was the right color, and it won out over the Navy's suggestion, which was going to be black and orange stripes, horizontal stripes. It's the so-called bumblebee effect. And the Army Air Corps suggested white and orange stripes. So the fact that that didn't happen because of Morrow's suggestion helped save the bridge so that it became what we know of today. I think it's interesting that Strauss is so very famous, and he does still get a lot of the credit, particularly as a propagandist and the chief engineer. But it was other people who came up with the ideas that that made the bridge so beautiful. Of course, the practical side of the bridge is that it opened up the North Counties to commerce, to tourism, and ultimately to gracious living if you could afford it in Marin County. Apparently, even coyotes like the bridge. They visit Golden Gate Park, and apparently they commute into San Francisco over the Golden Gate Bridge. So everybody likes the bridge. Yeah. It's a win-win. I think one of the interesting things about the bridge is that it was built at a time when Americans supported infrastructure projects. It seems amazing today that both the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge were built at roughly the same time. Both projects began in 1933. The Golden Gate Bridge was completed in May of 1937. The Oakland Bridge in November of 1936. The Bay Bridge was funded by federal money, Reconstruction Finance Corporation money, initially under Hoover, of all folks, and then completed under New Deal money when FDR was president, who became president in 1933 took office. So it had a lot of New Deal money into it. The Golden Gate Bridge was funded by private bonds that were sold in the counties north of in San Francisco and the counties to the north. And it, even though it was funded that way, it's still a large public project. Many public people were involved in it, so including a legislature. So it seems to me it's interesting that this comes at a time when Americans supported infrastructures. Also, the speed of the completion of the thing is interesting. In just 4 years, as well as a relatively speaking reasonable cost. To give you an example, the Golden Gate Bridge cost $35 million. That's in the 1930s, that would be about $600 million today. And by contrast, the new partial part of the Oakland Bridge cost $6.4 billion. It took 12 years to build and has been plagued with difficulties. So, you know, you're looking at a different era. To some extent, that's related to safety issues. The Golden Gate Bridge, for example, didn't have the kind of earthquake proofing that you had with the new Oakland project, which slowed things down. You have to have work in there that's permit temporary. It's called false work, and that had to be taken out, and that raised the price a lot, and that was to protect the building of the Oakland Bridge from earthquakes. So, in the 1930s, engineers didn't have to worry about things like that. So it's kind of a different situation there. Another thing that I think is really interesting is that in the 1930s, workers' lives were not held as valuable as they are today. In fact, in many ways, you can say they were held cheaply. At the time, in the 1930s, it was assumed as a rule of thumb that one worker would have to die for every $1 million of investment that was required to build the bridge, so 35 people should have died building the Golden Gate Bridge. The thing is, around 1936 anyway, the new union movement was afoot in the Bay Area, and it seems to me, you know, following the great 1934 maritime strike that was won, employers were a little bit on the defensive. Strauss himself, I think, I don't know this for sure, but I'm pretty sure that this is probably what he thought. He said, we're going to have to do some safety. We'll have to get ahead of the parade here. You know, the union movement is coming, and we better make sure we're kind of ahead of the parade. So he insisted that harnesses be used. He insisted that hard hats be used. These are innovations, if you can imagine, at the time. And here you have people, in some cases, 700 feet up in the air working over the ocean without this kind of safety. He insisted on that. He also brought the idea forth to have a net. It didn't cost a lot. It was made of rope, of thick rope, but this is the safety net. You see a picture of it there that Strauss brought in and said this is going to be important. He also coincidentally thought that workers would work faster over if they had a safety net under them. That was part of his thinking as well. The net is credited with saving 19 people who fell into it. One, of course, was Al Zampa, who was the fellow whose quote I read, and he is the subject of one of the chapters of the book. Those 19 people who fell into it and lived were called members of the Halfway to Hell Club, In part, I think that name was selected because if you fell, for example, from mid-span to 220 feet, you were going to hit the water at 75 miles an hour, and you'd probably die. Okay. Well, the 11 people who died building the bridge at least was not 35, and it was looked upon as being a pretty good record. 11 is better than the 24, for example, who died building the Oakland Bridge. At least 24. I've seen different figures, 26 and 28. But by and large, the Bay Bridge was more of a non-union job. By the time Strauss put the net in on the Golden Gate, it was 100% union. A little background maybe would help on the workers themselves. By and large, they were white males. Many were sons of immigrants, which I think is very interesting. There were some older guys who were actually immigrants themselves, but I think, as far as I can tell, a great number of these people were immigrants who had come during the migration from Europe, during the Great Migration of 1880 to the beginning of World War I in 1914 in Europe. Today we have politicians who condemn immigrants as much as they can. I guess they're making political hay, but I think it's interesting that our Great Bridge was built by and large by the children of immigrants. I think another unique thing about this book, is that there are testimonies from women in this particular case who had a serious role on the Golden Gate Bridge. One of the chapters focuses on two nurses who cared for injured workers, and there were quite a number of them. One woman, Alvina McIntyre, and her son, well, are pictured here, and they're standing during the great celebration in 1937 that was held in San Francisco when the bridge opened. She also talks about the anxiety of waiting for her husband to come home from work. To update the story, there's an African-American woman who worked on the bridge in about the year 2000. Well, I thought I'd maybe tell you a little bit about oral history, too, as a technique. It's direct. It's appealing. It has an immediacy that I think appealed to a lot of people. And I think maybe that's why it's enjoyed a vogue in recent years, and this book is driven by oral history. I have an introduction, and after that, the workers get to take over. The standard in oral history is what they call the full life history, when you were born, where you were born, you know, through to retirement. You have to do research in the library. You have to figure out things before you ask questions. You have to develop a question list. You have to stay alert during interviewing. It's not always the easiest thing in the world. You have to listen to the unanticipated thread that you want to follow. Sometimes the odd question you didn't anticipate can come up with the best answer that is in your whole interview. You try to develop as you go along to get the personality of that particular person. I like to think of it in my terms of what makes that person tick. And sometimes you can get that if you get that on the recording, you're doing well. For publication, you have a raw transcript very often. It could be 100 pages long. Some of the chapters in this book are maybe 15 pages, and some of them come out of 100-page transcripts. So what you have to do is pare down the thing. You have to edit it down. You have to organize things chronologically. You have to move material around. Some oral historians think oral historians do that. Some don't. I do, because otherwise it's a jumble. And that will make it readable. But the main thing you want to do is retain the tone, the style, and the meaning of the person who you've interviewed. I thought we might find it a little bit interesting to learn about oral history because there's a lot more to it than just recording somebody and then printing it out and calling out a book. Now let's turn to some quotes from the book. I'm going to start out with first days on the Golden Gate Bridge job. These are stories of people experiencing the bridge on their first day. Fred DeVita was the son of immigrants. He grew up poor in Marin County. He managed anyway to graduate from UC Berkeley in engineering in 1934. Okay, so he's got his great new degree. The only job during the Great Depression that he could get was as a paint scraper on the Golden Gate Bridge. So he did that on the North Tower. And by the way, 2 years later, because of his background and training, he did get to be the person who installed or was a supervisor for the installation anyway, of Strauss's safety net, which is very interesting. And all, you know, there's a whole chapter on him. Here's what he remembers from the first day, this is 1934, going up an outside elevator on the Marin Side Tower. The wind was blowing, the fog was coming in, and everything was dripping wet. You could hear the riveting hammers going, just noise. And here I am, a country hick, just coming in. I'd never been on a job like that in my life. Here I am, going up this elevator, up, 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 getting more scared as we get there. The towers are 746 feet high in the high. We were down near 710 feet. Then the elevator stopped. The elevator operator says, "This is where you get off." Two new painters were with me. We looked out there. To get off, you had to step on a 2x12 that was cantilevered out. In other words, across a piece of wood. The two painters looked. They looked over there and they saw the 2x12. They said, "Do we have to get out and cross that?" The elevator operator said, "That's the only way." The painter said, "No, take me down. I'm quitting." Then the elevator operator said to me, "How about you? Do you want to get off?" I thought a little bit. Then I says, "It's the only job I have. It's only 3 or 4 feet that you have to walk out there. I can make that." So I braved it and went across. So that's your first day on the job. Here's a guy named Glenn McIntyre. He's an iron worker. He worked as a Gandhi dancer. That's a railroad worker. Before he got a job on the Golden Gate, he was a fry cook and a bunch of other things. He worked on both the Bay Bridge and the Golden Gate. Here he reflects on his first day on the Golden Gate Bridge. He was putting up steel in a raising gang. The raising gang would put big pieces of steel up, and then they'd be bolted in, and later they'd be riveted. This is what he said, and this is, and includes his reaction to the safety net. He said, "When they sent me out to the Golden Gate Bridge, the first place they put me, I didn't have a net under me." That was before they stretched the safety net. In the raising gang on the Golden Gate, you didn't have nothing under you but the water. It was quite strict on your safety there, though. We used to get guys that would go down on the Bay Bridge. We used to count the guys who would go down on the Bay Bridge. It did you a good... It did give you a good feeling on the Golden Gate to have that under you there when it went in. And here's another person. This fellow's named John Urban. He was the son of immigrants. He was a cable spinner. So the cables were spun, including the huge cable that's 3 feet 6 inches in diameter. I guess it is huge cable that goes over. As I said, goes over the saddle. It was built by spinning system. It went back and forth and back and forth. There's something, there's quite a bit on that in the book. He worked on the huge main cable and it went over the saddle for the Golden Gate Bridge. And they're made out of thin little pieces. He said, "They handed me the end of this galvanized wire to take over the tower top. The wire was just a little bit smaller than the lead of a pencil." That's the way the cable is built. That first day I looked at the catwalk. Oh, the catwalk is a walkway. It's sort of a flimsy way that you would walk up to the top of the bridge. There's John Urban up there. That first day, I looked at the catwalk and up to the top of the tower, and I says, "Am I going up there or not?" I gritted my teeth and said, "Here goes," and I took off, and I went up to the tower top. You can imagine looking at that. And elsewhere, Urban also talks about being afraid of heights, too, but he overcame that because he had to, because he needed the job, and it's a Great Depression. Well, here's a little section called Describing the Work. And again, this is Glenn McIntyre, who was a riveter. And he describes getting a hot rivet ready for the rivet driver. The rivet driver would drive the rivet in using a rivet gun. And by the way, tools were used. You didn't handle red hot rivets by the hand, just to make it clear in regards to what we're going to be listening to. The forge was full of hot rivets. They have them stacked around the rim of the coals, preheated. They was heated to a cherry red. You'd take one off that, just like you were serving hamburgers. They'd throw the rivet, and a man would catch it in a catch can. He'd hand it to you, and you'd stick it in the hole. Sometimes, they'd start driving ahead of time, before you fumbled the rivet in. Then you'd catch hell. Them old guys, they didn't want to lose that, didn't want to lose a rivet because they had to heat another one to take its place. If a bad rivet cooled down too much, you'd have to take after it and use a hell gun on it. That's a 120-pound pressure gun. They're the same as a riveting gun, only it's a big one. A riveting gun had 90 pounds of pressure in there. With a hell dog, you'd drive the rivet back out. Sometimes it'd come out of there just like it was coming out of a shotgun. I guess you didn't want to be in the way of it. Wouldn't have been a good idea. McIntyre told another story about getting scale. That's splintered pieces from the hot rivet getting into your clothing, which apparently happened quite a little bit when people were riveting the way this was done in the old days. The old riveting system has been supplanted in the 50s and 60s. Anyway, if some of the scale from the Harvard got into your bib overholes or your boot, like when you were in a squatting position and your boots is open, you didn't dare lose that rivet. Sometimes the scale would get in your shirt and go down your stomach. You'd be there trying to wiggle away from that heat, but you'd stay there and burn. You never, ever give that rivet up. You'd try to turn the scale loose with one hand, but that didn't usually work. You'd stay there, and there's quite a few scars over that. It'll leave a mark on you. Al Zampa, who I mentioned before, was also the son of immigrants, came from Crockett, California. He was an ace, or expert steel man, expert iron worker. He also suffered a fall in 1936, broke his back, recovered, returned to work, became a high steel man again, and became a legend among iron workers. He still is a legend among iron workers. He's passed away some 10 or so years ago. He defined an ace in his oral history. He said, there's Al. He said, the good ones we'd call aces. That was a fellow that can do the work, do it quick, do it good, and up in the air all the time without a scaffold. Know nothing below you. I was one of the aces. So you can see the pride, you know, of a highly skilled craft worker. Here's another individual named John Noren. He was an elevator installer's helper. Sometimes he had to ride outside of a small service elevator while holding onto the cables, so he's on the outside, on the top. He said, when the little elevator got overcrowded, I would stand on a small beam about 10 feet above the elevator platform. You'd stand on that and hold on to the cable and ride up. I get used to it. But I felt very much relieved when we hit the road at 4:30 and you'd stomp your feet on the ground. And they generally quit around 4:30. It was basically 8 to 5. Here's a little bit on wages. This, again, is Glenn McIntyre. This section is called Wages and Hours. We was well paid. We got $11 a day for 8 hours. That was a good wage in those days. The bricklayers was the only ones in the crafts that made more than the ironworkers at that time. On the Golden Gate, we didn't get much of any overtime. It was an 8-hour day, and he was glad of it. Laborers were getting only about $5 a day. If you went up from 5 to 7, that was a good day's pay. So it is 1930s money we're talking about. I've called this section Desperation for Work. People being desperate for work in the Great Depression. Zampa noted the desperation of men looking for work at this time. He said, sometimes during that depression, I'd look down from the cable in the Golden Gate Tower when I was up there, and there'd be 150 people waiting for a job, waiting for us to either fall off or quit. Well, Glenn McIntyre also talked about the bridge's color, and he echoed what a lot of other workers thought about it. They didn't think it was all that important. Their concerns were not with the color of the bridge as such. They were the concerns of working class people trying to survive the Great Depression. His argument was that politicians, bridge designers, reporters, other people were preoccupied with color, but that wasn't the way the workers looked at it. This is what Glenn said. There was controversy about the color of the Golden Gate Bridge, the color it was painted, but that was for other people. I don't think it mattered to the iron workers themselves. It may have been important with the politicians who have something to say, one against the other. But the iron workers didn't care what color it was. Payday was 5 o'clock. Payday and 5 o'clock was what they were looking for. The color didn't make no difference as long as the green got in your pocket. You know, so, sort of a different view than many politicians and boosters and so forth at the time were interested in. There was a tremendous amount of hoopla over the bridge. You see huge photographs in the San Francisco Examiner filling up the whole page of the bridge and, you know, being built in progress and so forth. Well, this one is also called skepticism because there was some skepticism on the part of many people about whether this thing could be built or whether it would actually you know, work at all and so on. This is a guy named Bert Vestnes, who is a Teamster. He drove equipment to the bridge in the 1930s. And he remembered the skepticism of co-workers, and many other people were skeptical of the whole project, too. Like the iron workers, they thought, the Teamster guys thought of it as just another job. He said, there were a lot of skeptics back then that didn't think the bridge would ever be built. They thought it was a big pipe dream. The few local 85 Teamster drivers I talked to occasionally about the bridge just considered it another job. They didn't see anything special about it. Most of the guys didn't even think it would ever be finished. Amazing. Well, looking back, the people I interviewed kind of took a different view. They were proud that they'd worked on it, and they recognized it was something special. This is Fred Brusati. He was an electrician, and he thought it was something special, as did most of the people who I talked to who were builders looking back. He addressed the skepticism in the 1930s. This is what Fred said. Today, whenever I drive across the bridge, I'm sure happy to have been one of the workers on it. One thing I'll say is that the bridge was special because earlier everybody said that it couldn't be built. So after it got built, I said, I guess everybody who figured that this couldn't be built must have been wrong. It's all finished now, and it's going to stay up. And it's been up there a couple of years now, you know? He's saying that in the 1980s. Well, another thing the bridge is famous for is its weather, there are microclimates on the bridge. You know, you can stand at Fort Point or go up to the top of Fort Point, and you see sometimes it's different weather on the top at Fort Point. And this is just up five stories or so. This is the reference here is to the fort at the foot of the bridge in the San Francisco side. It's a Civil War era fort, actually. Long story there. This is what Fred Brusati said. Some days when you were working up on top, you're up above the fog. You could see all over, and it looked real pretty, like there was a blanket of snow there. Of course, some days it wasn't pretty. Then some days, when it was clear, it was hotter than blazes up on top. You'd go down to the bottom, and you almost freeze. And different people, and they referred to this in the book, have different experiences of the weather, depending on how high up they are on the bridge. Brusati also described how a wind could bounce the catwalk or a suspended walkway. There's the catwalk. You can see it there. You're walking over it, right over the ocean, at least 200 feet below you. The catwalk wasn't latched down or anything. The wind came up and started to bounce the catwalk all over one time. I had a safety belt on, and I just tied it onto the steel cables that were coming down to hold the catwalk. I said, well, if this thing flips over, I might be hanging up there, but I'll still be there. His condition, of course, might not have been so terrific if that had happened. Here's a guy named Martin Adams from the Ozark Mountains. He was a member of Local 261 of the laborers, in case we have anybody from that group here. Later on became a member of the Pile Drivers, local number 34 in the Bay Area. He described the cold weather when he was a laborer on the bridge. The gate was the coldest place I ever worked. You put all the clothes you could get on and you worked hard or you'd freeze. I'd been used to snow and ice. This wasn't snow and ice, but it was just about as cold. There was a little bit of ice a few times. It was cold, rain. It was a cold, rainy winter, and you were just careful. That is walking around. I wore a sweatshirt underneath, a shirt, I seldom ever wore long johns, but then I had a pair of overalls on and a coat. You'd put them all on and button them up. Well, here's another fellow, Fred Brissotti, who I mentioned before. He recalled the cold. He said, one extra morning we went out to work, and heck, all the water lines were frozen. There were icicles coming down, dropping that were up to 4 to 5 feet. Okay. Now we come to a rather grim topic, and this one is called Death on the Bridge. And some discussion or quotes regarding the 11 people who died on the bridge, 10 at one time. McIntyre described the October 1936 death of Kermit Moore, who is the first person killed on the bridge. McIntyre mentions a headache ball, which is a large construction ball. It can weigh several tons, and it's something that hangs down from a crane or hangs down from a boom, and it usually has a swivel and a hook suspended below it. He said, I felt the bridge shudder. The boom was swaying back and forth. Finally, it went over the side. I looked for my buddy. He was right there under the headache ball, and it hit him in the head. And that was the end of him. I ate lunch with him at noon, and at 2 o'clock, I went out and swept his brains into the Golden Gate. In doing this book, tried not to hold back. You know, you got to tell the story. You got to tell the full story. Brissotti, who mentioned before, was on the bridge on February 17, 1937, when the net tore and 10 people died. It is the net, there was a scaffold that fell, I may have forgot to mention this, a 5-ton scaffold that held some individuals, and the clamps broke, and it went down and tore the safety net, tore Strauss's safety net. It carried a dozen people into the hole, as the workers called it. Of those dozen people, only two survived. Brissotti was there, and he mentions a spud wrench, which is the big end of the wrench. The name comes from potato, of all darn things. He says, we could see the men out there trying to stay up. This is in the water. But heck, they had spud wrenches and everything else on them. They tried to stay up, but they just couldn't do it. Well, here's a person named Slim Lambert, Evan C. Slim Lambert. He's a former cannery worker in Alaska. He was an Arizona cowboy at one time in his life. He was a hobo. He's one of the two survivors. He was also a good swimmer, by the way. He recalled his fall from mid-span 220 feet into the ocean. And of course, the net slowed people's fall a little bit. And I think that's probably why Slim Lambert and one other person survived. He said, when I fell off the bridge, I did manage to hit the water feet first. The only problem with that was that I jammed down into the piece of net with both feet. I went down into that net because it stopped temporarily when I hit the water, and I was still moving. That's the only time I panicked. I was caught in the net, and it was headed for the bottom. It was dragged down by that 6-ton staging. I mentioned 5 tons. I've seen 5 and 6 tons up, you know. It was big. At first, I couldn't get loose. I was fighting it. Then I finally calmed down and began to wiggle. I slid right out of it, but I was a long way down because I was bleeding at the nose and the ears when I came up. And that's Slim Lambert. There was a lot of debris in the water. Lambert was actually badly hurt, broken bones and so on. He found some planks because there was a lot of debris in the water that some of the workers above had thrown some wood down, hoping people could stay up. Then he tried to save Fred Dumontson, who was another worker. Note, Fred Dumontson's family later on gave a family collection to the Labor Archives and Research Center at San Francisco State University, directed by Catherine Powell. And it's a very useful collection. I use that. I use many other collections, but I use that one, of course. Got a lot of help from the Labor Archives director. Okay. Lambert tried to prop up Dumontson. This is what he said. I saw Fred Dumontson threshing about. There were two or three people floating around. I had a choice. I went to Fred because he was still thrashing around, and I knew he was alive. The others appeared to be done for. Lambert also described getting picked up by a crab fisherman. He'd actually tried to flag down the Coast Guard, but he wasn't able to do that successfully. So he and Fred were picked up by the Coast Guard, and then he recounted what happened to Fred. When I was picked up, I had a dead man by the feet. That was Fred DeMotzen. Well, he wasn't dead. He was still alive then. He was alive until we were coming in off the crab fisherman's boat. On the way in, he died. He'd been moving up to that time, and finally he stopped. And there's more to the story yet. I mean, Lambert's struggle was quite something, and it's all recounted. I sort of tried to hit the high points for you so you get a feel for some of this. Well, a little bit on politics. This is sort of a section on politics. Al Zampa, the ace iron worker, was interviewed when Ronald Reagan was the president of the United States. Al talked about politics. Most of the interview subjects, rather, in this book, voted for Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, as you might expect, in the 1930s. Two of them later on became Republicans in later life, and, you know, I'm faced with that. What am I going to do with that? We let it all hang out and tell their story. Let them tell their story. Zampa, though, remained a lifelong New Dealer and a lifelong Democrat. He said, "I still remember President Franklin Roosevelt, who helped the unions. He was a great man. Now, Ronnie Reagan's there as president. He's against our union. He was a union man himself and president of his local. He was a Democrat. Now he's a Republican. I don't know. I can't understand his job, and I know he couldn't understand mine." Quite a lot that's being said there. Then I mentioned that there were women involved, as I said, a couple of nurses who took care of, and this is unique to this book. I've never seen any other reference to it. I've seen one line in which there was something about medical facilities being at hand, but I'd say the other literature is terrific on the bridge, the older books, but serious treatment of women's role somehow didn't get covered. The two nurses are Mary Zita Feliciano and Patrick DeWeese. They worked at St. Mary's Hospital in San Francisco, where they took care of the injured, and they had very different views of these guys, as you might imagine, different views of the builders. I know that photograph is really not Angel Adams quality, but that's the only picture I took that's in the book. I took that picture of the two nurses. Mary Zita Feliciano put it this way: "The men couldn't stand shots with this itty bitty needle. I gave one fellow an IV in the arm. Oh, he didn't think I could do it." Here were these big burly men building a bridge and going up near the top of these cables, and then you want to shoot them with a little bitty needle. They were like children. They were afraid. They were so afraid. I was a fiery little supervisor then. I used to go on the wards to see if the men were misbehaving. One day I went, and they were playing cards. All the cards were risque ones. Oh, you never in your sight. Now, the other nurse, Patricia DeWeese, was a lay nurse. She had a little bit different view. She said, among other things, those injured workers were very patient. Some of them were so sick, but they never complained. One man was there for a year. There was so much fuss about the bridge at that time. It's just a shame that there wasn't more done about the men that constructed it. They were the ones that did it, or we wouldn't have a bridge. Interesting comment, I thought. I have another section called Women and Discrimination. There were no women and no African Americans on the bridge in the 1930s, which is an unusual situation, but that's what it was. Things, of course, changed in later part of the 20th century, and Joyce Harris, named Big J, because she was tall, is an African-American woman who worked maintenance on the bridge in later years. Her testimony kind of brings the Golden Gate Bridge story up to date. She overcame racial and gender challenges, became a highly respected iron worker, and I think it helped that she was 6 feet tall and was an all-Army athlete when she had been in the Army. She said, by the way, this is in the last chapter of the book to kind of bring it up to date a bit. "We still had good old boys in our apprenticeship class. One guy, Dan, had a huge swastika tattoo on his arm. For 2 years, every other word was the N-word. Finally, I said, 'Dan, I've had it with you.' He walked in front of my desk and said, 'You, N-word, need to row that boat back. So I came across the desk on him. And after that, he changed his attitude, and me and Dan became friends. She was a very interesting and flexible and capable person. Okay. To kind of wrap up the formal presentation, I'd like to read you Joyce Harris's gracious final statement. Shorter than building a new Golden Gate, they will always be fixing that one. I went out there to help put up some stuff. They were going to do some rebracing. I was privileged to go all the way to the top and stand there. I was just amazed at the structure. The average person doesn't get to go and see how every brace is there for a reason. I thought about my brothers before me who put this thing together. It's a structure that people know and all over the world, and that day we got to get some steel ready to put in there. A lot of people don't get injected into history that way. We always will be part of it. It's not always about the money. And that's kind of the formal presentation. So, okay, thank you.
Great. I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Harvey Schwartz speaking on building the Golden Gate Bridge at the Commonwealth Club of California. It's time for questions and answers. I'll go around and pick up some cards in just a second. Harvey, while I'm picking them up, how many people were working on this? It took 4 years. About how big was the crew during different times? Obviously, they put the towers up first, and maybe you can tell a little bit about that.
One of the difficulties with that line of questioning is that the records of all the companies that were subcontracting companies have disappeared. The companies, that is to say, are out of business, and the records are not available. But I'm guessing a range of 1,000 or so would be out there at various times. It's a little bit hard to guess. In terms of crews, they weren't always so big. Like, there were a dozen guys on that scaffolding that went down, for example. They were really removing some false work on the bridge. But it's very difficult to answer that question, you know, with confidence, because the records are gone.
The first question is, your book mentions the use of lead-based paint, and that the workers did not use respirators. Obviously, that was a period of time and not knowledge. Was that lead paint ever replaced, removed, and was that a big project?
There was paint that failed, and that's why the first guy who I mentioned was up there scraping some of that paint off. There was lead-based paint, and some people did get sick from it. And so when that was discovered, the first thing that the bridge doctors did said was, go home and drink some milk, and you guys will get better. That didn't really work out so well. But they did bring in respirators, and there are photographs in the San Francisco Public Library's San Francisco History Room on the 6th floor that show pictures with respirators on. So they did bring some respirators in. How long the paint stayed on there that was lead-based, I'm not sure. It's continually being repainted, however, and it's to be repainted all the time to keep the weather from eating it away. I hope that's something of an answer.
One small follow-up on the painting. You say it's being painted all the time. Is there sort of a continual team that goes around and goes right back to the start and does it again?
Basically, that's the case. I think they select where you need to repaint it, and then that's done. But it's continually being painted.
So, next question. What was the typical work day for bridge laborers like? You said it was an eight-hour day, so they didn't do overtime. But
They didn't do overtime on this particular job. It was basically, I think, about an 8 to 4 job, maybe 8 to 4:30, and it took you 20 minutes or so to get down off the bridge if you're up top. But it was basically an 8-hour day. They didn't have overtime very much, at least as far as I can tell, on this particular job. They still built it in 4 years. So, there was overtime in other places, like the warehousing industry in San Francisco in 1934-35, you had to come in, for example, and work 4 hours on a Saturday, so it was a 44-hour week. The Fair Labor Standards Act, limiting things to officially 8 hours, hadn't come in yet. So there was overtime, and of course, in the warehousing industry, before the Longshore Union organized in that realm, you didn't get overtime money. It was straight time.
You mentioned that the Bay Bridge to Oakland was going up at the same time. One of the questions is, was there competition between the two teams, and did the beauty of the bridge come into play or not, or did the laborers not care about that part of it?
As far as I can tell, the workers weren't that concerned about one being more beautiful than the other. I don't think they felt a competitive sense. They wanted a job. The idea was to get a job and to survive the Great Depression. One curiosity that seems to me to be related to that question is Al Zampa himself said he thought that the old Oakland Bridge is prettier. And I thought it was more beautiful. I'm trying to figure out why he thought that. And he said, well, you have Camelback span. There was those five pieces that were on the Oakland side. You have a suspension span on the San Francisco side. You have cantilever spans. It was several different kinds of bridges in one. And he said, you know, for to the eye of a high steel ace, you know, that was more beautiful than the single span system of the Golden Gate Bridge, which is really interesting, it seems to me, because, you know, so many of us look at it and think, oh, you know, look at the beauty and grace of the suspension bridge, which is the Golden Gate. The other one looks like a jumble, the old bridge. But Zampa didn't see it that way.
You mentioned that they both started around the same time as a follow-up, but that the Bay Bridge was finished earlier. Was there any kind of competition towards the end? We're going to try to finish before the other one, or was it? No.
I don't think there was, as far as I can tell. One of the things that slowed down the Golden Gate was the San Francisco side tower was a difficult problem. It had to be built out in the ocean, and there was several starting and stopping. It was something like 1,000 feet out on the ocean. I don't remember the exact figure, but it was way, way out there. And there was a causeway that was built, and it got destroyed and beat up in an accident. One time, I think a vessel hit it. It was just a really, really tough tower to build. Finally, it did get built, but it took a little bit of an effort to do it. It delayed things for 6 months or a year, so that may account for the difference in time.
The next question is, who was the big employer? That you said this was done by a bond issue, and so that was partly privately funded. But who was the employer, and did the workers organize, or was the way that they treated, they didn't have to organize, he just hired the workers? And he wanted to know whether it was before the Wagner Act.
Well, it starts in 1934. The Wagner Act is 1935. Can I see the paper again? I'm trying to remember all the questions.
Who was the employer?
Oh, there were several employers. As I recall, there's something like 11 subcontractors. Bethlehem Steel was one of them. There were just a whole number of them that did certain different. Roebling was the one who was in charge of the spinning of the cables. So there were several employers involved. And then you had another interesting part of the question.
The other part of the question was whether, you know, the workers organized or whether the employers just accepted that they were union workers and only 100% union.
Now, that's a good question. It's amazing that I didn't remember it, because it's a good question. Basically, there was not too much difficulty in organizing. The subcontractors kind of didn't fight it. As I say, the great strike in Maritime had been finished in 1934. There are a couple of workers in the book who mentioned, well, we didn't really have to do too much to organize. All we had to do was just kind of do it. One of the guys says one of the employers kind of came to us and said, you know, do this. And so we did. I think the reason that it was not so difficult was because the employers for the moment were on the defensive right after the great 1934 strike. So by the end, it is 100% union by the time it's finished. And I don't remember there being a real big battle over unionization.
Next question is about the safety net, and you mentioned that Strauss just brought the safety net in. Do you know whether there was any negotiations behind the scenes with the union about that ahead of time, or whether it was Strauss's idea or anything else?
It's usually credited as Strauss's idea, and I think it was Strauss's idea. One of the workers mentioned safety. Remember, I'm paraphrasing a quote, your safety was coming in, but the unions didn't have a lot of power yet. We didn't get the safety in as a union group. We didn't get a lot of safety insisted upon at that point in time. So I think it was basically Strauss's baby to bring that net in.
And has this been called the safety net? I mean, I know the safety net was also applied to like Social Security and so on and so forth later on. How long has this term safety net been around? Do you know, or is it, you know, was it around on bridges when the pier bridges were being built?
I would imagine, in this case, I have to imagine. I think the term safety net is probably post-World War II. It's probably post-New Deal, or maybe it came in with the New Deal. But I think it's likely to be a post-1930s and 40s reference. I don't really know that for positive. But I think the safety net was called that in the 1930s. That is to say, the rope safety net. I think they probably used that term. At least I seem to note that in much of the literature.
A big policy question for today. In the 30s, a lot of public construction was done, big public projects, a lot of government money went into that at a time when we were poor. Now we're rich, and there seems to be, although obviously there's a $6 billion bridge that was just built, but people feel that there's not as much being done. Is there any kind of weight to that, or is it a misperception?
Oh, I think there's weight to that. I think public projects of one sort or another just aren't getting built. And I think there's, some of our politicians are against it. I think you might have had a bigger public program of some kind in the 2008 recession if there'd been more stomach for it in Congress. I think that's a possibility. I think Obama would have liked to try that. He got, some programs going, but he didn't get what I think he would have liked to have gotten, which would have cost more. And there's also an anti-spending perspective, an anti-spending of money on by borrowing it, which is what Roosevelt did. And there's kind of a bias against that, which seems to be built throughout the United States and Europe, and seemed to be important in the Great Depression, in the 2008 recession. Personally, I think that's a mistake, but I think there's a kind of a feeling against investing in public projects. I think it's unfortunate.
A question that comes up in that same context. How many construction workers are unemployed, so that if you developed a bunch of projects, would you be able to pull them in, or is it just not available because there's been such a lack for a long time?
Well, the construction trades are cyclical. That is to say, they're like the birds in the canary cage. When times are bad, they're among the first people to go down. That is to say, to lose their jobs. Now, right now, jobs are coming back, so there are some more jobs in construction trades. And I think a lot of people who were unemployed now are getting jobs. I don't know if that's, as happy a situation as you might hope. But it is cyclical, and I think there's some more jobs now than there were, say, in 2010, now that the economy is a little bit better.
Does anybody have another question? This will be the last one. Great. So last question is, what is the Golden Gate Bridge's lifespan? Are there many usable years left, or is it on its last legs? It's been up a long time.
The rule of thumb that is supposed to be standard, as I understand it, is about 100 years. So we're coming up to 80 whatever at this point. We just had 85. It seems to be in pretty good condition. There's work being done on it all the time. There's retrofitting being done on it that's supposed to be done in the year 2021. Things take longer than they did in the Great Depression. Actually, that retrofitting is going to cost more. No, that's not the retrofitting. That's really a long term. There is a project for example, a safety feature to be built in. And that's going to take a long time to be achieved and going to cost a lot of money. I think maybe it's got a long time to go. I don't know that for sure. I mean, it is a suspension bridge, and it depends on the ability for it to move rather than on strength, which, of course, can be compromised by earthquakes pretty darn easily. I have no idea how long it's really going to last. I hope it's going to last a long time myself, but then I have an axe to grind, right?
And we hope this lecture will last a long time. Thank you very much, Harvey, for good information on the history of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Thank you so much.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.